Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, and welcome back to New Books in Genocide Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm host of the show. And I haven't posted a podcast for probably 2 months because I've been on the road taking students to Europe and going to conferences, but I'm excited to be back. And I'm particularly excited to be back to talk about a very interesting book, titled Jasenovich Concentration Camp, An Unfinished Past, edited by Andriana Bencic-Kuznar, Daniela Lucic, and Stipe Odak. And just by hearing me pronounce those names, you are going to recognize that my Croatian is non-existent. And so I will apologize in advance both to Stipe and to our listeners when I mispronounce something. But it's well worth hearing the mispronunciations because this is a really interesting and important book. And I'm looking forward to talking to Stipe about it. And I'll let him explain why it's so important. So I'll just say, Stipe, thanks for joining us and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies.
Thank you for having me, Kelly. It's wonderful to be here.
So I start out by asking guests to tell us a little bit about themselves. And in our case, since your co-editors are not with us, Stipe, if you could introduce yourself to us and then say a little bit about your co-editors.
Sure. So my name is Stipe Odak. My background is a little bit specific. I studied theology and religious studies and then sociology and comparative literature in Zagreb. And then later went on to finish a PhD in political and social sciences. Coincidentally, two other co-editors, so that will be Daniela Lucic and Andriana Bencic-Kuznar, were my colleagues. So we studied sociology together in Zagreb and then continued to work together. And we came in touch with the subject of Jasenovac towards the end of our master studies. So that was Andriana and me at the time. We were invited by the director of Jasenovac Memorial Site at that time to do some research, basically, at the museum. And the issue was quite peculiar. So the people who were visiting sometimes demanded to see more horrors. They thought that the museum does not represent the history in a truthful way, and that they would prefer to see more weapons, the images of massacred bodies, uniforms, war uniforms, and so on and so on, which was strange in view of new developments in museological representation. But it was also ethically problematic, and we'll speak probably about this later, in view of particular history of Jasenovac, where the museological representations were used as a part of propaganda during the war in the former Yugoslavia. So this was the first time we came in touch with the subject in a professional way. Of course, this was before taught in history classes and even some university classes that we attended. And then we continued on, and the subjects changed over time. So at some point, we also collaborated with people from other museological sites in Europe in imagining how the museological representation of the Holocaust should develop in future, especially at that time, the development of augmented reality was quite in vogue. And that, again, also became relevant to Jasenovac because the site, the original site, was bombed in March and April 45. And then even later, people from surrounding villages used the remnants of the site for as a construction material for the houses. So there was almost nothing left, which creates a strange sensation among the people that the site is too beautiful for what it represents. And one of the possibilities or suggestions that some of the visitors were giving was to reconstruct the places of torture, which again opens many ethical questions. So we want to avoid that. And one of the ways that we could imagine going forward was to use this augmented technology, to represent what the site looked like at the time, while at the same time reminding visitors that there's a difference now. And also there was an educational point that we wanted to send, stating that the last phase of genocidal ideology is not the genocide itself, but covering the traces of genocide, which was quite visible in the case of Jasenovac. So that was the original situation. And then later we faced some additional problems. And one of them was a new wave of revisionism surrounding the Jasenovac site. And also under quotation, birth of new research institutions, which were publishing quasi-academic works on both sides. So one side was exaggerating the situation of Jasenovac. Again, this should be a qualified statement because it's very difficult to exaggerate the site of such terror. But what I mean by that is that they were using the data from Yugoslav, especially late Yugoslav period, which was a part really of propaganda during the war. So that was one side. And another side, partially as a reaction, was minimizing the horrors of Jasenovac. Inspiration behind the book was to bring together scholars from different countries, different fields, but scholars with a reputation who would really insist on data-driven research, empirically grounded research, which can present truthfully the story and history of Jasenovac, and which can help, in a way, to bring different perspectives together, but which can also serve as a repository of data which people can use in response to revisionist tendencies that they face. So that's the story of a book, and we are happy really that it's been published now.
Some of our listeners may be familiar with Jasenovac, but most are not. So can you talk a little bit about what this site was and what role it played in the Second World War?
Sure. So first, maybe I should geographically place Jasenovac. So at that time, it was the biggest concentration camp in so-called independent state of Croatia. So now we are speaking about the period from 41 to 45, of course, the period of the Second World War. And the independent state of Croatia was an ally state with Germany and Italy. So the famous Croatian historian Ivo Goldstein used these terms under quotation marks, stating that it was neither independent, neither Croatian, since it was in nature not really independent. So it really depended a lot on Italy and Germany. And it was not, again, entirely Croatian, because, of course, it was not a democratically elected government. So it comprised the territory of currently Republic of Croatia, Bosnia and Herzegovina, parts of what is today Republic of Serbia, minus the Istria, that's a region in Croatia, and some parts of Croatian coastline, which were then given to Italy. So we are there. This is the geographic space. So Jasenovac was not the oldest concentration camp in this country, but it was certainly the biggest. And later it became a symbol used for all concentration camps in this large territory. And this sometimes creates confusion, because sometimes people would speak about Jasenovac victims, but under that name, they would include all the victims of all concentration camps on this territory, right? So that's why it was an extremely powerful symbol. It will become clear why in a minute. So also, it was not a single geographical spot. In reality, it comprises five sites. So first two were operating really in a relatively short period from August to November 1941. And then the people who survived were then sent to camp number three, called Brickwork, which is generally associated with the name Jasenovac. And then there was also a tannery and another site placed in what is currently Republic Bosnia Herzegovina, in Stara Gradiška. So there was this complex set of camps, which were all called Jasenovac concentration. Which role it played? So very early after their founding, the leaders of independent state of Croatia introduced racial laws based on the racial laws, of course, in Germany, which targeted specifically Jewish and Roma population, all non-Aryans, but practically Jewish, Roma, and Sinti population in these territories. And aside from that, Serbs were not considered non-Aryan race. They were not considered directly targeted by these laws. They were Slavs, but neither Jews nor Romans. So they were then seen mostly as political enemy within. And then many of them, the majority of victims in Jasenovac concentration camps were of Serbian ethnicity. So those three groups were systematically targeted. And aside from them, there were other enemies who were seen as, again, political enemies. Those were Croats in opposition, also significant number of victims were of this ethnicity. There were also some smaller ethnicities who lived in these territories, but were also seen as a target. For instance, some who belonged to religious minorities. It's important to note that the camp was not controlled by Germans, as some other camps in Europe were, even outside the German territory. This was under local control. And another difference to concentration camps in Germany was the way it was organized. So it was not just a concentration camp, it was also a labor camp and extermination camp. And Nataša Matavšić, one of the people who contributed to this book, described it in comparison to German industrial machinery of killing, using that metaphor, as a manufacturer of all evils. And it was truly a horrific place, full of sadistic stories and really torturous killings on a daily basis. The number of victims of Jasenovac concentration camp, as we might discuss later, was always a matter of debate. But the Jasenovac Memorial Site institution that is now organized on the place of the spot of the former concentration camp did an important research project in 2000s, and currently, they have a list of all victims' names, which is 83,145, I believe, which is not a complete list, but that's the starting point. And the generally serious academic approximations go so between this lowest number of 83,000 to 120,000 of victims, mostly converging around 90,000, 100,000 victims. So already enormous number in itself. So Jasenovac concentration camp later during the Yugoslav period of the communist government, symbol in a way of national unity. Why was this important? Because Yugoslav government at the time was inspired by this ideology of brotherhood and unity. So the idea was to avoid the repetition of these, they call it fratricidal crimes, internecine crimes between the ethnicities who were culturally close, speaking, well, basically the same language, sharing the same mentality. And starting from the suffering, they wanted to build something common, something together. So in that sense, it was strongly discouraged, even impossible, to speak about the crimes of one ethnicity over another. So the victims were Yugoslav people, and the enemy were fascists and their collaborators. So this was the official denomination. And this was somehow manifested also in organization of the museum. So the symbol, architectural symbol of the site, became a stone flower, which is enormous concrete building by Bogdan Bogdanovich. And it is really a stone flower. It symbolizes something that has roots deep down in ground, in suffering, in blood, in terror, but it's open towards the sky, towards a new future. So the orientation was really towards future. So starting from this deep suffering towards some building better, well, in that time, communist future. Later on, in late 80s, so especially after 87, the narrative changed significantly. So one wizard from Academy of Sciences from Belgrade was organized in 87. And the decision was brought to change the organization of the museum and represent it more as a site of deepest atrocity. So that was the time when these real horrific, authentic but horrific images of massacred bodies, movies, and all the rest was presented in the museum. Usually all the children from these territories of Yugoslavia at some point were obliged to visit this as a part of school visit. And also a mobile exhibition was organized titled "The Death Are Opening the Eyes of the Living," which was especially visiting the military barracks. And then this became a huge issue later during a war, because some people testified that they saw this suffering. And mind you, at the time, the narrative changed significantly. The suffering was not the suffering of Yugoslav people or all ethnicities. It was in the eyes of the propagandists, the Serbian suffering. And the perpetrators were then Croats. So the people who saw the exhibition would say, "I saw what happened and I reacted preemptively to stop another genocide." So the museum and the museological exhibition itself was used for propaganda purposes. And then it was fueling different crimes during a period from 91 to 95. Then also during the war, the museum was under occupation of Yugoslav National Army, was pillaged, and all the property, all the books, all the exhibition was moved to Banja Luka. It was only later brought back to Croatia, and then it was finally decided that a different form of exhibition, permanent exhibition, should be organized. And in 2005, the work started, and the new exhibition focuses on the victims. The project wanted to show that the victims are not just a number. Those were people with specific histories, specific personalities, who lived again in their communities. So the idea was to give them give back the voice to the victims. So it's really focusing on that historical context, of course. There's also part which represent the resistance in the camp. We have truly fascinating stories sometimes, for instance, of women who wrote a cookbook of recipes while they were imprisoned there. And this is astonishing in a way. The book was written during a period of starvation, and they saw it as a form of resistance. So the women would get together and think about recipes. Mind you, the paper is not readily available in a camp. It needs to be stolen. And again, if you're caught writing this, you would be immediately executed. So this was seen as a form of resistance, but also keeping the heritage, because the recipes used to be transmitted from mother to daughter and so on, especially in older societies. So there was some form of importance of guarding that tradition. So they would write a cookbook together. Then there were souvenirs. For instance, one male inmate made a ring for his friend. Both of them were working, forced to work, and the ring was, of course, hidden. Inside the ring, there's an inscription, "This also will pass one day." So there were those elements of hope, strange hope in face of nothingness, resistance. And then again, inmates try to resist the impression. So in 45, the camp was that way also liberated. So the focus was a lot on this, and then much less on truly the weapons, on destruction. There's a small part of exhibition which shows them, but this is not, certainly not in the focus. So this new exhibition was partially well accepted, and then again, partially criticized by some people who saw it as a postmodernist attempt to negate the horrors of the history, or by some as revisionist attempts. The one part, of course, of the project was to find a name of all victims by names. So again, the book was published with all the names of all victims that could be found. Of course, not all the names could be found, but those that could were written in a book. And the book came, as I mentioned before, with a little bit more above 83,000 names, which was much less than official propaganda in Yugoslavia, which was partially developed in attempt to reinforce the sense of suffering, and again the enormous evil that happened during this period, which can be a source of inspiration for future generation, and partially as a way of asking a monetary reparation from Germany. So some listeners probably know in 1946, there was a conference in Paris organized around the question of reparation. And Yugoslavia at that time said that the victims of in this territory of Yugoslavia amounted to 1.7 million. And this number, we later discovered, was the estimation by Vlade Tavuchkovic, who was working at the statistical office. And he made an estimation of demographic losses, so which are different from real victim losses. Why they're different? Because there he included also the decline in birth rate. So everything that contributed to kind of less population that one would expect, including people who were killed, but not only people who were killed, right? In practice, this is an important number to know, because people, for instance, who leave the country or people who couldn't have children are also an important element in social life. Of course, we need to know this, but these were not meant to be the actual victims killed on these territories. Nonetheless, the number was used during this conference, later became quoted in encyclopedias, official publication in Yugoslavia. And another thing that was important as a symbol was 700,000 victims of Jasenovac. This almost became a sacrosanct number, which simply symbolized this enormous suffering, which we know now is not factually true. So when the last exhibition of Jasenovac, permanent exhibition of Jasenovac was made with this number, which is much less than this one used before, some people also saw it as a revisionist attempt. And then now we are here today when all these things I just presented, I know they can be very confusing to hear all this, because Jasenovac is really specific site in this respect, which has not only the original history of terror, but also the history of collective memory around it, a history of propaganda around it, an additional traumatic history of the ex-Yugoslav wars, which were linked to previous wars.
That's a wonderful summary of the history of the camp, but also of the ways in which the memory of the camp has been used. And you talked a lot about numbering. Your book divides this into three parts: naming, numbering, and narrating. I wonder if you could say something about the naming part. What are the how have people described this? I'm particularly struck by descriptions of this as something more than genocide. So how have they described what happened at Jasenovac and around it? And what are the stakes with that?
Mm-hmm. Maybe to make one step back, yeah, even to explain just the division of the book,
yeah, please,
in describing, naming, and counting. So we started with the premise that genocide in itself is a crime which escapes understanding to some degree, and especially it escapes representation. It's linked to this idea of radical evil, which simply cannot, in full at least, be properly represented. So people usually develop strategies of representing those horrible events. One strategy is doing historical research, right? That's what most of us do. But there are also different strategies around this. So one of them is giving a name to a crime. So genocide, of course, is an important term that was developed to describe these unimaginable events. For a long time, the Holocaust and all these atrocities that happened during World War II were seen as a crime without name. So there was a necessity to create a name for this deep suffering. Linked to this is history of Jasenovac, which was a site of genocidal execution. But then there were also attempts to represent this history as something even beyond that, sometimes used also for political purposes. So you mentioned, for instance, the at the time president of Republika Srpska. Again, maybe a little point of clarification. The Republika Srpska is not the same thing as Republic of Serbia. Republic of Srpska is a federal entity of Bosnia, of state of Bosnia and Herzegovina, right? So one part is Republic of Srpska, another part is Federation of Bosnia and Herzegovina, which is again might be a misnomer because the federation is on the lower level than the state. And the third part is Brčko district. So Republic of Srpska is a place where this one part of former concentration camp is currently placed. And it's the events, memorial events are organized every year, which is fine, all fine in itself. It becomes problematic when this history of suffering is used for political purposes of today. So Željka Cvijanović wanted to say that Jasenovac, as a place of Serbian suffering, was not a genocide, but something even more than a genocide that exceeds all other forms of suffering. It's so unimaginable. And then this is linked to the idea that the only protector against the new suffering is Republic of Srpska. And this, again, was the idea proposed on numerous occasions by another important politician from Republic of Srpska, Milorad Dodik. At the same time, very often, this enormous, truly enormous suffering of Serbian population and other ethnicities as well during World War II, in Republic of Srpska especially, is used as a way of not speaking about crimes, especially genocide in Srebrenica that happened in 1995. So this strategy of naming was in a way political strategy to convey the idea that the current political institutions are the main protectors of Serbian people in this territory, and they have legitimacy to speak about suffering, because so many people suffered, and they suffered something even more than a genocide. On the other hand, among the revisionists, there was attempts, and there are ongoing attempts, to represent the events surrounding Jasenovac not as genocide, but as simply reasonable political decisions against enemies of the state at that time. Some of them even go to the length of stating that the site was not even the place of execution. It was to a degree a place where they could organize movie nights, sports and recreation. So place of relatively comfortable living. So this attempt of avoiding at all costs the name genocide is also an attempt to whitewash the history. So that's the naming part and struggles around this. And our listeners will certainly know and understand that there's always this attempt to appropriate the word genocide, and sometimes, or most frequently, the word Holocaust for other forms of suffering. But in an attempt to say, yeah, we also have a legitimacy to speak about pain, about collective trauma. So naming. Then the second strategy of representing this enormous event is, of course, through numbers. If the suffering escapes understanding, then perhaps we can put a number on it. We might come closer to some form of proper representation. So that's also another reason why the numbers were so important in this context. And we also mentioned the number 700,000. It's already a number which is easy to remember, unlike, for instance, 83,145. So it's became a symbolic number. In a way, for some people, it did not represent exact number of victims, but it just represents a symbol of enormous suffering, which simply couldn't be touched. The number became less a number itself, mathematical instrument. It simply became a cognitive instrument, a cognitive symbol, right? And then on another hand, of course, on a revisionist side, we see a strong attempts to minimize the numbers of people who suffered there. And then they would go to the length of saying, oh, just maybe 2,000 people were suffering. Of course, both of these strategies are problematic from historical point of view, but they're also problematic from social and in a way political point of view, because they create mistrust. And once when all this suffering and the numbers became symbolic, it becomes almost impossible to debate the symbols. Because negotiating symbols and touching the symbols is already seen as an insult. So that's why the naming is also something that we definitely wanted to talk about. And then the third strategy of representing genocidal crimes is through descriptions. So usually the strategies here revolve around attempts to represent the most atrocious forms of pathological tortures that one can imagine. Right? Some of them were historically accurate, and some of them, which are also linked to the history of Jasenovac, historians really have consensus around this, were not accurate. And one, again, very famous story was this sad story about making soap from human remains, which is said to be done in this territory of Stara Gradiška, for which we don't really have historical evidence. But the attempt here is to come up with something memorable, something which shocks people, something which creates emotional reaction, also as a way of representing something which escapes understanding in itself. And as I mentioned before, revisionist attempts go in a completely other direction. Oh no, this camp was not really the place of suffering. Yeah, it was a labor camp. It was imprisonment, but relatively comfortable one. So let us describe you what happened there. There was this movie presented there. There was a visit of Red Cross, which saw relatively comfortable conditions at that time, and so on and so on. So the description of the events surrounding Jasenovac and then happening in Jasenovac is also a battlefield of arguments. And well, Not just arguments, I must say, also arguments under quotation marks, because some of these are clearly not historically based statements. So finally, we decided to organize the book in those three sections, which deal with those three strategies of speaking about the crimes that took place between 41 and 45 in these locations.
There's a name that plays a role in the book that you haven't mentioned this, and I believe that's Bleiburg, I believe, if I've got that right. How have people tried to, so what is that? What does it represent anyway? What does it stand in for? And how have people tried to use that as a narrative strategy for, in order to cement kinds of identities or stories that they tell about the past?
Mm-hmm. So Bleiburg, in itself, is geographical location, is simply a city in Austria, but it's actually a symbol for a set of events related to May 45, which make the whole story about World War II in these territories of ex-Yugoslavia extremely complicated to comprehend. So at the end of the war, the army, together with some militia groups from different territories, so some from Bosnia and Herzegovina, some from Serbia, some from Slovenia, some from Montenegro, withdrew also together with a part of civilian population to this city called Bleiburg, which is at the territory of Republic of Austria nowadays. And they surrendered eventually to Allied forces. The winning side on the territory of Yugoslavia were partisans under the leadership of Tito, which then became Yugoslav army. So what happened later is that British leadership decided to repatriate all these people back to the country itself, and then give them basically as prisoners to Yugoslav army. So that's the generally the framework, historical framework of events. So what happened later were, in a part, revenge killings and then massacres over not only former army members, but also civilians. So I just spoke before about the history of Jasenovac and somehow the numbers of people killed there. So Blyborg was another enormous suffering, which stretches from these initial events of surrender all up to the time when many of these people came home. So this created another controversy. Why? Because during the period of communist Yugoslavia, it was practically impossible to speak about these events because those included the crimes of the regime. So until very late, basically, until the fall of Yugoslavia, these events survived almost exclusively in collective memory. There were some publications about these events in immigration, but it was simply impossible to have books about them written and published in Yugoslavia. So why is this important? Because to a certain degree, there were no research being done, serious research being done for quite a long period of time. And second thing, this was a neuralgic point for many people. So now when the research about Blyborg started to be developed later, after the independence, the numbers were also controversial. So nowadays, most researchers converge around the numbers between 70,000 to 80,000 of people who died, or some approximations grow from 50 to 60. So the numbers are not very clear. And the majority of victims in this case were of Croatian ethnicity this time. So why is this important? At one point, when Jasenovac became appropriated as the place of almost exclusively or predominantly place of Serbian suffering, Blyborg was developed as another symbolic place of Croatian suffering. And then it was shrouded also in religious language. So the Blyborg is also known in Croatian language as a way of the cross. So these events were seen as a way of the cross. So from surrender, torture, until some of them came home and many of them died. So this is the setting that we have. And then those two symbols of suffering were sometimes used, again, also in non-academic literature, as a way of contradict each other. So people would say, oh, you see, the Jasenovac was not first minimizing suffering of Jasenovac. Jasenovac was not such a big form of suffering, whereas Blyborg was, and both sides were guilty of these enormous crimes, which again they would say the genocide took place in both cases, depending which publications you're reading. So that's one event. And then on another side, there are also attempts to say, yeah, but these crimes and these forms of suffering are not exactly the same forms of suffering, because one form of suffering took place during a regime which introduced racial laws and implemented them during 4 years. And another form of suffering, in this case, Blyborg, was a mixture of revenge killings, so linked to the suffering of Jasenovac, and then some chaos in the army that was not well organized, especially after the war. So even nowadays, those two toponyms represent two sets of different narratives, two sets of different emotions and unfortunately also competitive victimhood. So one of the goals of the book, Ken, and Vladimir Geiger and Athena Grahek wrote a great article about this, was finally to shed some empirical lights on these events. And we somehow tried to help people to converge around some form of approximation first, how many victims took place, but also about timeline of events and why causality of events, why some of these events took place. So that's basically, in a nutshell, the history of Bleiburg, which is far more complex than what I just said now, but it really represents something important in collective memory, to a degree that very often, even nowadays in comments after the random articles that you will see in publications in these regions, you will often see these competitions between Jasenovac, Bleiburg, what happened when, who suffered more, and so on and so on.
So as I mentioned at the beginning, this is a region about which many people, certainly in the United States, but I think globally, don't know very much, and one in which 30 years, well, not quite 30 years ago, but 25 years ago, was much more visible in the public consciousness, and I think it has receded. So I guess my first question about this is why do you think that what happened in the Balkans during the Second World War is so much less understood than what happened in Poland or Ukraine or Belarus or wherever? What can we learn from events and the memory of events in the Balkans that will help us better understand how to wrestle with these issues historically and politically? Mm-hmm.
I think there's several reasons. One, and probably a very important one, is the sheer complexity of these events. So what you have here are ethnically quite diverse territories, which later became six independent states after the fall of Yugoslavia. And then the territories themselves were just difficult to understand what happened when, how, and for what reason. So that's one. Second thing is that the events intersected and went in different directions. So somehow you couldn't make a simple narrative out of this. As I just mentioned, Bleiburg tragedy was also an enormous tragedy, but was committed at that time by the state forces at the end of the war, so after the surrender. So it's somehow difficult to create a simple narrative and timeline of events. Second thing is also the number of forces who were fighting on these territories. So, and alliances. So you did have state forces, but then you also had militias, some supporters of the Royal Army, who were quite fighting the regime, but were also adhering to fascist ideology of a different kind, or supremacist ideology. So all this is, I understand, it's very confusing. Okay. Second reason, I believe, is that the events that took place in 1990s, the beginning of 1990s, the war and dissolution of Yugoslavia, were enormous shock for political analysts, geostrategists, and so on and so on. And they took place after a long time. So when we already thought, oh, but we learned the history, we learned the lesson of suffering. We taught so much about the crimes of the Second World War. So it was somehow difficult to imagine the new crimes would occur again. And then yet you did have the wars in Yugoslavia, and then you had 1994, obviously, Rwandan genocide, which were a wake-up call, I believe, globally. And then the media coverage focused mostly on these events in 1990s. Whereas it would be the former crimes were forgotten, but they were intrinsically linked to the later crimes, especially in this segment of collective memory, right? And finally, maybe a reason, the last reason that comes to my mind now would simply be the change of the focus. So this region of Southeastern Europe and the Balkans was for a while under the spotlight, and then later simply different regions became the hotspot of interest. So not so much is being published about this region anymore, here and there, yes, but it's certainly not the center of the interest. I believe because the conviction is that these events are not so relevant anymore. They're not so urgent. They do not require immediate reaction or immediate attention. And as a reply to that, I would really say that these stories that I just presented could truly offer extremely valuable and important lesson, because one, they were so complex, and this complexity makes them even more relevant. Because again, the very issue of memory and suffering and trauma and remembrance of events, it's quite complex in itself. And it's tempting to understand historical events in simple oppositions between the victims and perpetrators, whereas in many situations, the story goes in many different directions. It's difficult to represent. It's constantly asking us for new attention, new articulation. So that's an important lesson to learn. And second thing, it's also to see how one memory of suffering, which was meant to be a unifying memory, can become reappropriated in different ways. And in the worst case scenario, it can also be a ground, a fuel for new crimes. And this requires constant ethical attention.
So this is a wonderful book, and it seems to me to represent a kind of strategy of truth-telling. Maybe not truth-telling, but accuracy-telling. I'm not sure that phrase works very well in English, but an attempt to lay out a very carefully, to use a European kind of framing, scientifically a determined and articulated view of what happened. That is an element of a strategy. So maybe I should reframe the question like this. As historians, social scientists, theologians interested in trying to ensure that history doesn't become a weapon, how do we do that? This is one element of a strategy, but how do we try and work to prevent history from being misused in a way that creates more violence rather than less?
This is a very good question. And there's truth in this that you just said about truth-telling. No pun intended again. that truth can have different meanings. And it's accurate to say that the truth can have different forms. And as we remember for famous South African case, they could be forensic truths, they could be a narrative truth, they can be a social truth, a community truth, but restorative truth. There are many ways of phrasing the truth, right? And I understand that. But at the same time, and this might sound extremely empirical, maybe, if that's a proper word, we did believe that we need to have a very dedicated and transparent historical research based on hard historical evidence in order to help the discussion moving forward. Why? Because many forms of representing the past, and I mentioned some, do represent something truthful to people. So even the number of 700,000, it's true in a sense that the tragedy was enormous, right? But if we represent truth in this way, this can easily contradict the other forms of truth. So other forms, especially of symbolic truth telling that different groups develop around their tragedy. So we believe that starting from these, well, simple empirical work around real concrete victims and victim names and numbers would be a way of bringing those diverging views closer together. Of course, we are aware that we cannot expect that people will, all people will agree on all things. That will be a utopian dream. But at least to create a platform around which this discussion would develop, would lead forward. And we are happy to say that in this book, we had a collaboration of, on one side, two Croatian scholars, writing about the victims of Jasenovac and Bleiburg. And on another side, Dr. Cvetković, who's coming from Serbia, who made independent research also about the victims of Jasenovac, which came close, quite close together. So we were kind of vindicated in this belief that this can help in moving the discussion forward. Right. So there was this ground belief that we had. Another thing was simply the threat of revisionism. If we simply allow the history to become a field of discourse, so any form of discourse, this can easily fall prey to revisionist narratives. Right, because then they would simply spin the history in a certain way and say, well, this is our truth now. And if all truths are placed on the same level, then there's really no way of adjudicating around them. And mind you, this is also ethically problematic. We quote at some point the statement of Professor Moises, who says, inflating victims is extremely problematic because symbolically you're killing more people. And negating victims is also extremely problematic. So you're not acknowledging them, right? And so both of them are simply the strategies we absolutely wanted to avoid, especially knowing that practically they can be employed for new crimes as a motivation, a partial motivation, clearly not clear causality is the place, but partial motivation for new crimes. So we did really start with this deep belief that we need to have this as a basis, insisting on what can be called forensic truth or, well, accuracy to some degree. Aside from that, we did allow space for further discussion. So we do have contributions about movies, for instance, about Jasenovac. And many of them, which represent the story of Jasenovac in different ways, as movies always do, right? Or a museological representation. So even if you do agree on some, let's call it ground truths, this still does not tell you almost anything about the representation of these events, you see. So this representation is another form of speaking about history, which cannot be placed in concrete numbers or equations, right? So this was somehow the motivation behind this. And it's also answered the question, how do we avoid this? One of the core beliefs that we had was really trying to establish consensus and a broader and broader consensus about the accuracy of historical findings. That's one. And second thing that we constantly insist upon is related to presentation of the tragedies, that they always need to have this empathy element or the view of the other. As soon as the narrative becomes closed narrative, so self-centered narrative, this can easily become exclusivist view of the suffering, which is suffering just for me and for my community, right? Which doesn't tell anybody else what to do. So this is not to say that the way forward is universalization of every suffering without any specificities. No. What I'm trying to say goes along Rothbard's idea of multidirectional memory. We need to start from something specific. Right. If we start from universalist suffering, we cannot say anything about specific suffering. If we start from specific sufferings and then make connections, seeing the similarities and differences between them, we can also then eventually understand something about universal human condition, all the while being able to go back to specific suffering. And this is truly my conviction that this is the way to move forward. And another element that really need to be preserved, it might sound banal, but I think it's also humbleness. Humbleness about what we can say and do about history. So Marie-Claire Lafabre, the French historian, uses two terms. They rhyme in French, not so much in English. Is the choice of the past, choix du passé, and the weight of the past. The choice of the past is the strategy of selecting historical periods that we decide to talk about and to learn from them. On the other hand, it's also the weight of the past, because the some events in the past are so weighting on our shoulders so much that even if we decide not to speak of them, they will still persist in collective memory. And Bleiburg perhaps is a good example. The regime decided not to speak about these events, but then they couldn't be erased. The weight of the past was simply too large. So way forward would be first to become aware of this, that we're not really omnipotent when it comes to the past and speaking about the past, to become aware of these differences. And then with healthy degree of humbleness, trying to build something common, some platforms that can develop a future dialogue, that can inspire future dialogue among different participants and different subjects and different groups.
That's a really thoughtful answer. Thank you so much. We've reached the hour mark, so it's time to wrap up. So I always ask the same question to end, which is to say, can you suggest to our listeners a book or two or movie or something that was important to you while you were thinking about these issues? That, I mean, it's July, we have a tiny bit of vacation left before the academic year starts, something we can read or watch before we have to go back to grading papers.
Sorry, there was another interruption.
Yep, I can hear you.
You can hear me. Yeah, well, since this the story really about the World War II on these territories is so complex, I could perhaps recommend two books. They're both in English, which are written in a quite accessible way, and they explain these complex histories in a kind of easy to understand way, still scholarly books. One is War and Revolution in Yugoslavia, written by Jozo Tomašević, which is again a famous publication. Another book is The Holocaust in Croatia by Ivo and Slavko Goldstein. It is a bit unfortunate that the majority of publications are still published either first in Croatian or exclusively in Croatian. So there's a significant body of scholarship, of literature, which is unfortunately still inaccessible. But those two books can be a good starting point for future reflection and future exploration and further reading.
I will add them to my list. Sadly, I've had a lot of plane time this summer, and I will have more. So I always get strange looks from the people who are sitting next to me as I pull out my books, and but I will add to my education. We have been talking to Stipe Odak, one of the co-editors of Jasenovac Concentration Camp, An Unfinished Past. Stipe, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And I know you're working on a project about Rwanda. When you are done with that, I hope you'll join us on the show again to talk about that book.
It would be a great pleasure. Thank you, Kelly, for having me.